Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, The Low Post. It's the number one NBA podcast for a reason. Top executives, coaches, players, and the best analysis in the game. Be sure to check it out. You can download and subscribe to The Low Post now, as well as the right time, wherever you get your podcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, COVID came, college football still the same. I'll tell you what I mean about that. And also, Steph put up 60 and change. Do I owe him an apology? But first... Oh, man, Gabe, we are back. Happy New Year. It's, you know, it's been one of those things. Lots of changes going on in the world in various places or whatever it is, man. Happy 30th birthday to you.
Appreciate it, man. Appreciate it.
You know, you over there in that black and white striped shirt looking like you celebrated your birthday by stealing hamburgers.
This is navy blue.
Oh, it's navy blue. Okay. I like the shirt, right? It's just, you know, it's just the Hamburglar, which, by the way, I don't know if that even means anything to you. Are you familiar with the Hamburglar?
From what I remember, is more of a Happy Meal toy than an actual thing.
No, there's a character. The Hamburglar was a character. It's like the Hamburglar. It was Grimace. It was like the little bird, I got to remember sometimes that would be something that maybe you know, maybe you don't, because like I just turned 40, you know what I mean? So I don't always know how far down the Hamburglar goes. I'm finding that when I tell jokes to people around your age, sometimes y'all just be laughing, but I realize that y'all don't actually know what the hell it is that I'm talking about. Like I tell you, when I was doing the research for the college football stuff, it was talking to guys and I said something about Voltron and dude was like, what's that mean? And I was like, no, there would be no reason for you to know who Voltron is, 21-year-old. Sorry, I'm just out here dating myself. Who knew? Yeah, it happens. You can look it up. You'll when you see it, you'll be like, oh, okay, I get, you know, form like Voltron. You'll understand in the circumstances where that's used. But let's talk about the things that have not changed. It's the first week of January, and that means I be out here talking about the same damn thing every year. And you know what that is? The damn Rooney Rule. Every year, we wind up back in this situation and this circumstance. And Gabe, it's probably going to go the damn same at the end of the coaching carousel and the hiring and everything else, where it comes time to knock the dust off, y'all. Damn, the NFL don't be hiring black coaches column, right? It just seems like everybody rattles off that same column every single year, right? And then the same people on the other side come back with, well, who are the people that you think should have been hired? Like I'm some kind of goddamn HR officer or something like that, right? I just know that every damn year, it seemed like it goes the exact same way. And I'm not inclined to litigate every single individual case because that kind of misses the point. It's a macro level phenomenon. Everybody got a story on why they did each individual thing, but the individual things keep stacking up into the same macro level conundrum, right? That sort of thing keeps on happening. The other thing I like to argue back with people about when they hit me with the, well, who are the people that you think that should have been hired? Did you think Zach Taylor should have been hired? Had you ever heard of Judge Joe Brown up there with the Giants, for example? You know what I mean? Like y'all don't know who these people are. Y'all have no idea who they are, but they keep finding white folks, pulling them out of thin air, making them coach. Zach Taylor was the big one, because that's when they was just looking for anybody that touched the hem of Sean McVay's garment. You remember that game when Sean McVay was a genius? You remember that? And they was just trying to get any of his partners, any of his homies to get on, and they went with Zach Taylor, a dude who basically had gotten all his jobs on the basis of the fact that he married Mike Sherman's daughter. You remember Mike Sherman used to coach the Packers, coached at Texas A&M. So he got on. Now, he was a good quarterback. He was like a first-team All-Big 12 quarterback, Taylor was, when he was at Nebraska. And so he got on with Texas A&M when Sherman was the coach at Texas A&M as a graduate assistant. And then Sherman brought him with him to Miami after Sherman got fired by the Aggies, and then when Sherman was the offensive coordinator with the Dolphins, And then he brought Zach Taylor along. And now Zach Taylor done won 6 games in 2 years, and they're keeping Zach Taylor. Now, are they keeping Zach Taylor with those 6 wins after 2 years because he's white? No. They're keeping him because Mike Brown is not going to pay somebody not to work. Like, he's just a different level of cheap. He could have Coach Farrakhan in there, and if Coach Farrakhan got 3 years left on his contract, please believe Mike Brown going to get at least have him work the next two. Bet that. He ain't paying nobody not to work. That's not how he gets down. Now, this year becomes interesting in our Rooney Rule carousel because nobody can really make the argument of, well, where's the black guy you should hire, right? The obvious answer here is Eric Bieniemy. That is the guy. If you are the guy that is the offensive coordinator of an offense like the Chiefs, typically you then move up to go get a bigger, better job, which is being a head coach. Doug Peterson, that's how he wound up in Philadelphia. He was the offensive coordinator for Andy Reid with the Chiefs. The next one, Matt Nagy, that's how he wound up in Chicago, offensive coordinator. There we go. Bieniemy, the offense has been better than it was been with these other guys. And you can make the argument, well, he's got Mahomes. Well, Mahomes didn't show up like he was, right? You would assume that Bieniemy had some role in improving Mahomes and helping him get to where he is. Like, you're going to see Brian Daboll, the offensive coordinator for the Bills, who I think has done a great job as an offensive coordinator. You're going to see people talk about him in the context of the improvement of Josh Allen. And we witnessed the improvement of Josh Allen, like with our own eyes. We saw what he was in 2018. We see what he is in 2020. We're going to give Brian Daboll that credit when it seems to me, from what I've read, the person who deserves the most credit for that is Josh Allen. Like, the thing I gave you, every time I talk about Josh Allen, what do I always say? He seems like a cool dude to me, right? I say this every time, okay? But my man Charlie Kravitz, who is a producer on Highly Questionable, he always makes the point, he was reading this, that basically Josh Allen went and looked at his own game and said, yo, I have got to fix some things. Like, my accuracy, intermediate, and all of that stuff is just abysmal. I have to improve this. And it appears that he went in the offseason and worked with Jordan Palmer and improved it. Like, he became a much better player. Like, I saw something, I watched a lot of ESPN over the break, and they were talking about, remember when the narrative about Josh Allen was that he was inaccurate? And they're like, he completed 52% of his passes as a rookie, and this year's completed 68% of his passes. That ain't a narrative. Those are numbers. Like, they're right there directly in front of you. But that dude went and got better. Daboll is going to get the credit from a lot of people for the fact that Josh Allen got better. Okay? Mahomes didn't wind up where he is by accident. So, like, he gets some credit for that one. How does this go? And I talked about it on Twitter. Now, granted, it was with randos, but I saw them start making all the excuses for why it is that maybe Bieniemy wasn't, you know, this guy, maybe it wasn't it. They're like, well, he looks like Matt Nagy 2.0, which seems to be a little bit lazy, right? I also acknowledge, to be clear, none of us typically know who is or is not going to be a good head coach. Like, I do think a mistake that people make is they look at a guy as a play caller and they say, or, you know, as an offensive or defensive coordinator, that's how they determine whether or not somebody should be a head coach. I want to know somebody who never called plays before he became a head coach, Andy Reid. Like, he made himself the play caller and then is everything that's gone from there, but he was an offensive line coach. Being a play caller, having been a play caller before, to me, an overrated part of being the actual head coach. John Harbaugh was a secondary coach and then became the special teams coach and then became the coach of the Ravens. And the thing I always say about John Harbaugh and special teams coaching and why I think that's a good place to start being a coach is he is coaching a bunch of dudes, none of whom got into the league to do that. Like, except for the kicker and the punter, there is nobody who is living the dream playing special teams. Nobody wants to be there. And you got to figure out how to get that together when you don't have a whole lot of time with those guys, so forth and so on, right? There's a lot of different ways and reasons why somebody should be an NFL head coach, right? Most of those reasons are things that us as the general public, that we're not going to be the ones to know, to understand, and to figure out. That's also why, for me, why I said earlier that I don't litigate individual cases so strongly, unless it's just something that just jumps out that is like staggering and indefensible, right? So I remember there was this one dude in the NBA, I won't say his name, but year after year after year, we would hear, man, this guy's going to be a head coach, year after year after year. And every year, that dude ain't turned out to be no head coach. Every single year. And then he got the chance to be a head coach one time, and it was a disaster. And he went back in to be an assistant coach guy. And I talked to somebody who talked to somebody, and they said that they had had him in on it. Somebody had him in on an interview at some point, and it was terrible. Like, he was dreadful in the interview. And that was a big part of why the dude was not getting head coaching jobs. Like, that's the explanation for him. What is not possible is that there's an explanation for, like, every single black dude that tries to get a head coaching job. You see what I mean? Like, that's where this gets off and gets to be odd, is that, wow, every time you wind up having a story. So, like, I advise for people, if Bienemy doesn't get a single job offer this time, then we got some questions. But you're going to hurt yourself trying to argue, well, why didn't he get this job? Well, why didn't he get this job? Well, why didn't he get this job? Because somebody's going to have a story on every single one of those jobs. The person that they're hiring, in all likelihood, is qualified to be an NFL head coach also, right? The problem that black people have under these circumstances is, if they can find a qualified white man, then they're not going to hire the black dude, right? Like, they go hire the black dude in the absence of a white dude that they want to hire, generally speaking. That's why you see so often, especially in college, when it's time to make history, you go hire the black dude, right? Like, oh, damn, we just had to fire our coach in scandal. What are we going to do? Oh, there's some black dude that'll take this job. Yeah, why don't you come on? Like, I remember at one point in college, both of the football playing schools in New Mexico, New Mexico and New Mexico State, they both had black coaches. I was like, damn, y'all couldn't get these jobs away, huh? That's how we wind up getting there. But it always turns into, like, these angry arguments on the internet about the Rooney Rule. And the part that always breaks my heart when that happens is, dog, we just talking about job interviews. There's nothing in the Rooney Rule that indicates or mandates that you have to give a person a job. They're just saying you gotta give them an interview. That's it. Because these white folks are so untrustworthy in the NFL when it comes to hiring that they had to be threatened with litigation to interview black people. And year after year after year, knowing what the rule is, they still get up here in many cases and make the decision about who it is that they want to hire without having an actual process, and then get at the end to be like, damn, we got to go interview a black person. And so then they got to go find a black person that is either willing to subjugate his dignity or so, like, thirsty to get on the radar that he's willing to go along with what is, in effect, a sham. And because they can't tell the black people apart, they don't understand that under those circumstances, there's a difference between calling Marvin Lewis for your sham interview versus calling, say, in this case, I'll throw out Raheem Morris, right? Now, Raheem Morris has been a head coach before, but he's just been kind of off the radar. Like, he hadn't had a head coaching job in 10 years. He's just been kind of off the grid in terms of somebody that you think of as a head coach. So maybe you need, you know, wants to come in and get his name out there. Mike Tomlin, for example, did that the year before he got the Steelers job. He had gone and made the rounds for jobs that he was not going to get, but that's what got him on the radar to the point that the Steelers even knew or thought to call him in order to get there. All right. Like, an up-and-comer, you do that. But not somebody with receipts. Like, when Jerry Jones did that thing where he would call Dennis Green, had a telephone call with him and tried to call it a Rooney Rule interview. You don't do that to a man who's been to the playoffs 8 times. Right? But to them, they all just the same. To them, they don't even see that the Rooney Rule is there to help them, not to hurt them, not to cause some inconvenience. The Rooney Rule is making it possible that you might hire a better head coach than your silly race-addled mind would be able to find by yourself. Like, somebody's doing you a favor, being like, yo, you thought about interviewing some black dudes? Well, actually, no, I hadn't. Do you know any? And it improves the likelihood that you might be able to get this right. Like, y'all are the winners here. And so when I see, like, the angry arguments of people being like, oh, you know, it's, the job should go to the person that's most deserving. You are assuming under that principle that all these white dudes getting these jobs are by definition more qualified, right? If you think that's what it is. And the only time that you out here like, I need to make sure that the person who's most qualified gets the job, that only turns into a problem when a black dude gets out here. Wasn't too many people too mad again about Zach Taylor, wildly unqualified to get the job with the Bengals. They weren't so mad about Zach Taylor getting that job, that he has performed about at the level that you would have thought of somebody being unqualified in order to get the job. Ain't nobody out here being like, man, I just so wish qualified people would get jobs. No. But when somebody wants to call Eric Bieniemy in for an interview, now we talk about something different. Now we got a problem. Now all of a sudden you care about meritocracy. And I'm not calling all the people that get this wrong like transparently racist. I don't think a majority of them even give a great deal of thought to how baked in this racism is, such that when a white man is in a position, you assume that he should have been there. When a black dude's in a position, you ask yourself how he got there.
To that point specifically, you were talking before about how the one offensive coordinator that gets like knighted, the next one for the head coaching job, usually they talk about it as this person has options.
Yes.
Where do they want to go?
Yes.
Not will he get an offer, right?
Right.
Like Bieniemy's doing all these different head coaching interviews. These should be his options, right?
Yes.
Where he wants to go, because he's the one, right?
Yep. That's my read on this, is that he should have a choice of jobs. One would think, because again, I don't know what it looks like when he goes in there in those rooms. I don't know what it looks like when he presents, but I don't know what it looks like when any of these other guys go in these rooms and present, but somehow they wind up coming out of there with jobs. They wind up coming out of there with offers. Now, this is where it's going to get really interesting this year with the Rooney Rule. And I talked about this briefly on Twitter. The Atlanta Falcons have an opening at head coach. Okay? They got an opening at head coach. What makes the Falcons different from literally every other NFL franchise, right? No other owner has explicitly marketed his team to black people like Arthur Blank has. He did it walking in the door. Now, I've never seen anybody really spell out how he came to the conclusion that he was ultimately going to do this, but I think that he was like the first owner in the history of Atlanta sports to get bright, look around, and realize that white folks in Atlanta have done everything they can throughout the last 50 or 60 years to move far away from wherever black people were. I recommend you read a book called White Flight by Kevin Cruz. He's a professor at Princeton who lays out the situation on this. And basically, like I was reading something yesterday or a couple days ago about this nursing home that's not too far from where my parents live. It's over off of Cascade Road. And the nursing home has just been ravaged by COVID. Like COVID has just come through and laid waste to it. And somebody did a story that was about basically how COVID has ravaged that nursing home in a way it has not ravaged other nursing homes in white neighborhoods owned by the same company. You know, but one of the details that they had in the story was about how the neighborhood used to be all white in the mid 1960s. And see, that's crazy to me because my parents moved there in the early 1970s and it was already all black. Like all it took was a black person to show up and all the white people dipped. That was it. They wasn't waiting for black people to take over the neighborhood. They played out the game theory and was like, oh, they coming. We out. Right? That's Atlanta. That's what Atlanta has been historically. And so when people talk about Atlanta being a bad sports town and the fans don't want to come to the games and not selling out playoff games, it's because them white folks move so far away that getting into the city to go watch the Hawks, basketball becomes its own issue, right? Or to come watch the Braves in the neighborhood that they used to be in, they wasn't doing that. They weren't willing to. And then the Falcons on top of that were always sorry, right? Arthur Blank came in and was like, wow, it sure seems that a lot of black people live around this stadium and these white people aren't buying tickets. Maybe we should try to market the tickets to them, right? Like slash the prices on the upper deck, all of this stuff. And if you go to a tailgate outside the Georgia Dome, like you go to a tailgate outside AT&T Stadium, Jerry World, it is a representative cross-section of America. If you go to the tailgate at the Georgia Dome, it is a representative cross-section of Atlanta. Right? Very black, very white, like it kind of a bit of a split here, but it's the most integrated place in the city of Atlanta in large part because Arthur Blank decided he was going to market his team to black people. That's a huge part of why it's that way. They had the Michael Vick situation, like all of that stuff, right? They haven't had a black coach. Okay? They have not. If Arthur Blank doesn't make a real, real concerted effort to see what's up with Bieniemy. Like, if he doesn't hire Bieniemy, he's going to have to explain it. It's simple as that. Like, he's going to have to explain it. You could argue that he should not have to, but he's going to have to, because he's selling his product to a different audience. He's selling his product to a different set of people. And what appears to be the guy that most of us would think would be the hottest candidate on the market is a black dude in this black city with this black fan base playing in this black neighborhood. Although I think it's still black. Who knows? White folks coming back. So what you gonna do? That's gonna be the one for me to watch. Like, ultimately, what do you do? Now, would I want that job if I was Bieniemy? Probably not. The Chargers job, that one looks great, right? Herbert. Problem is, it's the Chargers. But you got Herbert there. The Jets job, not a bad job. Small problem. It's the Jets. That's the thing, right? It's the Jets. The Jaguars job, potentially good. Got a lot of draft capital. Probably going to have Trevor Lawrence. Small problem. Jacksonville. I didn't say the Jaguars. I said Jacksonville. And this is what I'm going to say, okay, for any of you that are out here in Jacksonville. I am not in a position to say how racist your city is or is not. I haven't spent enough time there. I don't have the answer for that, okay? I don't know. However, the perception outside of your city is that your city is wild racist. That is what people think. Look, I'll never forget this. You remember when Byron Leftwich played for them? There was a point, I think it's when Shaq Harris was the GM, but they're 1, 2, and 3 on the quarterback depth chart were all black dudes. And the theory that had been posited was that they had black backup and a black dude behind him to stop the locals for screaming for the backup at every turn. That was the way to do it. You know who Lamar Jackson's backup is in Baltimore? Robert Griffin. The Ravens are very aware that they got a black quarterback and what that means, you know, but that's how people see it. So Bieniemy should have choices. He should. Let's see how it shakes out in the end. Okay. And I will say this again, you're not going to do well litigating every single individual case, but if in the macro, it keep looking the same every damn year, you know what the problem is. How do you fix it? I don't know how to make these teams do what's best for them if they would rather lose than even talk to a black person. So college football season is almost over. We got one more game left to play. And I feel like the motto of this season is COVID ain't stopping us. Like, the whole plan and the whole attempt at this was to operate in spite of COVID, like to kind of act like COVID-19 was not happening. They had to cancel a lot of games. It was really weird. They got as much of the money out there as they possibly could. A lot of players tested positive. We'll see how that ultimately affects them down the line. But college football was not going to let COVID stop it. They were not. And what I think is most interesting about college football in the face of COVID and COVID not stopping the party, they still out here firing these dudes with these giant buyouts. Still out here doing it. Like, let me ask this question, because I haven't seen this reported anywhere. Maybe this is something that's being said quietly. But is there any coach who got to keep his job because his bosses looked around and said, yeah, they had a bad season, but, you know, it was COVID? Have you heard that about anybody? Because I ain't heard that about nobody, all right? In the face of COVID, as being a circumstance that affects what's going on, they still shelling out these buyouts. Gus Malzahn got fired at Auburn. They shelled out a $22 million buyout. Tom Herman got fired at Texas. They shelled out $15 million buyout. Will Muschamp got fired at South Carolina. I think the buyout for him was $13 million. Still shelled it out. Y'all swear up and down to me that they ain't got no money to pay the players, right? So in this year where revenue has been threatened like it never has, in this year where they can't really sell tickets, where games that were supposed to be televised are being canceled, which means they're not getting the money, in the years where a lot of these bowl games had to shut down, which is then also affecting people's money, right? One thing we know, COVID didn't make any of them any money. COVID, at the very least, cost a lot of people a lot of money, and they still out here shelling out these buyouts. None of them were looking at their coaches and saying, well, wait a minute, guys, these were trying circumstances. Nope, because COVID wasn't going to stop the party. Everything kept on going. And y'all swear up and down to me that they ain't got the money to pay these players. They got $13 million to pay Will Muschamp to go home. They got $22 million to pay Gus Malzahn to go home. They got $15 million to pay Tom Herman to go home. But you swear up and down they ain't got no money to pay players. That's what y'all stay telling me, that they ain't got no money to pay players. It's absurd. It's ridiculous, right? And that's where COVID has just laid the game bare. And by the way, if you got the money, I don't blame any of them for making those moves. Once you decide it's time to move, then you got to move. Okay? So at Texas, for example, with Herman, we knew time was up. They let the word get out that they were trying to hire Urban Meyer. That didn't work. How was Herman going to get any recruits after that? So what were you going to do? Set fire to an entire recruiting class? Right? For the second time in like 4 years? Is that what you were going to do? Set fire to an entire recruiting class? No, you weren't going to do that. You had to let him go, right? And so they made the move. I get it. I'm just saying, you got the money when you want the money, right? And by the way, those boosters, they shell out money for players. How do I know this? Because the only reason they don't is the NCAA. And NCAA ain't really stopping them, right? But I wanted to talk about the Texas job and what happened with Herman. Because, I mean, you know, that's my squad. That's my team. I ride with them. It hasn't done very much for me for the last 10 years. You know, we always have 2005. That was great. But I want to just run a suggestion out here to all the athletic directors in America, everywhere you go. I just want to tell you something that you can do for your fans. Okay? Just hear me out. So at Texas, I feel like we were basically all out on Herman. Time was up. Nobody seems to like him. His teams were not especially good. Players don't seem to like him, right? The high school coaches in Texas swore they liked him more than Charlie Strong. And for a year, he seemed to get those players, but we ain't really seeing that really trickle down. They had to hire a coach from Alabama to try to fix in-state recruiting, right? Like, that's kind of where Texas has gotten. It's a weird situation, and there we are, okay? We wanted Herman gone. We've been wanting Herman gone. I said early in the year it was going to be very simple. Beat Iowa State, keep your job. Lose to Iowa State, lose your job. Lost to Iowa State, eventually lost his job. Got it. So Texas fired Tom Herman. I was feeling pretty good about that. Like 20 minutes later, I see a report. Texas hires Steve Sarkisian. What? Now, Gabe, you're a Pac-12 guy. Do you know what they was calling Sark when he was at Washington? Seven-win Sark.
Okay.
You've heard that one. Seven-win Sark. Here's the thing. Sarkisian has had two head coaching jobs. He coached at Washington, and he coached at USC. Chris Peterson succeeded him at Washington and outperformed him. Now, to be fair to Sark, Chris Peterson is like a Hall of Fame-level coach. Okay. But Clay Helton replaced him at USC and did better than he did. And ain't nobody calling Clay Helton Hall of Fame level coach. That's not what it is. All right. So as soon as you fire Herman and now you hire Sarkisian, then all of us are over here like, damn, I don't know about this one. Could you have just given us a day to be happy that somebody lost their damn job? Like you gotta understand this. You don't really get too far out here celebrating people getting fired, right? Like, it's in bad taste, especially in the face of a pandemic, except when somebody get $15 million in their pocket to hit the road. So when somebody gets $15 million to hit the road, we get to be happy about it. We get to celebrate it. We get, you know what I'm saying? Like, we get to lean in on it, right? Finally, we are done with this coach that none of us like, and you didn't even give us a day to enjoy it. That was it. Look, when you propose, you don't have to set the date immediately. It's not required. Take some time to enjoy being engaged, right? You get divorced, you don't have to get married tomorrow. And that's what they did. And what a questionable hire. What a questionable hire. Like, it might work out, but it was questionable. Like, it wasn't like, hell yeah, we got Steve Sarkisian. No, like if you had got Urban, you could have done that. It'd have been like, hell yeah, we're going to be good for a little while. Like, I don't know how long, but we're going to be good for a little while. We'd have been happy. Hell yeah. Way to bring Urban Meyer in. You know what I'm saying? No, you brought in Steve Sarkisian. That's who you brought in. And didn't give us a day to be happy that it ain't Tom Herman. What? Go ahead.
What's disappointing, I would imagine, for you is that you measure to some degree your happiness with who your head coach is by how happy or unhappy rival fan bases are.
Yes.
When Sark was the head coach at USC, there was nobody happier than the folks over in Westwood.
UCLA.
When Sark went up to UW, it's like, oh, well, hey. At least we kept him in the conference, right?
Oh my God, I hate this. Just, we're never gonna be good again. Did I say we?
Yes, you did.
Fact still stands.
Yeah, I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry. Yeah,
it happens. Let's talk about something else. Gabe, your man Steph Curry put up 62 points the other night.
With that haircut, too.
Yeah. He put up 62 points the other night. I was watching them play some last night. They got a big win over the Sacramento Kings. Now, Steph, as you may have seen it, Gabe, he was I feel like Steph is not the person that people want Steph to be. Like, this is not a bad thing necessarily, but he's small and petty in the ways that great players are very often small and petty. Like, me and Shannon used to always talk about Steph Curry, humble superstar, right? Like, everybody wanted to make him into this person that he honestly is not. He is a cocky, swaggering jerk on the floor, just like most people who are great players tend to be, right? Doing all the airplane stuff and everything else and da-da-da. Like, he's that guy. Now, what gets me about that with him is you weren't doing none of that at Davidson. You weren't doing none of that until you became the MVP. Like, my issue with him on those things is it doesn't feel natural. It feels like he's playing a role. Like, he started doing his little shoulder shimmy and stuff like that. Like, maybe I missed it when he was doing it when he was younger, but I didn't really see it until they became, like, champions. Like, this don't feel like this is actually who he is. But no, Steph is a guy who heard Dame Lillard say, it ain't as easy for you now that you're not getting all these easy looks. And then he came out here and he put up 62, right? Gabe, you know they lost the game before that by 25 points, right?
You did say that when I brought it up and I went back to check the box score just in case.
Yes. They lost by 22 to the same Portland Trailblazers, by the way. They lost by 25 points and Steph in that game put up 26, not bad, right? Not bad, but they got beat by 25 points. Now, a couple weeks ago, or maybe it was a couple months ago, me and my man Vinny were on here talking about Steph Curry, and we got into the, like, Steph as superstar thing, and he and I were trying to discuss something with a certain level of nuance about, like, the unique quality to Steph Curry's game, and the Warriors fans were not here for this. They harvested a small bit of it and they stayed mad and they stayed as he scored 62 points. All of a sudden I got people in like, oh, you can't trust Steph to go one-on-one, huh? Like all this stuff. The point that I felt like I was trying to make, and it was something honestly I had not thought about that much until I saw Grant Hill say it once on NBA TV, which is Steph is a great player, but Steph is not somebody that we really think of as like this great one-on-one player, right? Because I think the thing that made people mad, including Steph Curry, about the podcast is we made some reference to him being like the greatest system player of all time. But like, oh, you're just saying he's a system player. A few people, including Andre Iguodala, responded and said, well, Steph is the system, which is true. But that's where this gets to be interesting and ironic, is that if you have Steph, you are able to put a system around him that'll give you a team that can win 73 games with the right pieces, right? So, like, LeBron James never been on no team. I think 66 is, like, the top for him in terms of win total, I think, on a team. You put Steph with another great shooter and with a ostensible post player who can distribute, right? You can turn this into something completely different than anything that we had ever seen in the history of the NBA. You put Steph out here with a team full of bums, they're probably going to win, like, 30 games out there. Okay. I feel like, and I could be wrong here because this is just a hypothesis. If I put James Harden out there with a bunch of bums, I think they probably win closer to 40 games than 30. LeBron James, in that first year with the Lakers, those guys were like overwhelmingly young, so I wouldn't call them bums necessarily. But I mean, you saw what that team was before LeBron got there, right? Before LeBron got hurt in that first year with the Lakers, they were fourth or fifth in the West before he got hurt. Like, they had really started to round into form. If I put LeBron on a team with bums and I put Steph on a team with bums, the floor for the LeBron team with bums is going to be higher than the floor of the Steph team with bums, right? And that's something that's kind of interesting when I think about Steph Curry. Because when we think about like great basketball players in the NBA, one thing they typically give you is a high floor just by their mere and simple presence. Like, if you really start trying to go back in your mind and be like, yo, so how many great players over time played on legitimately bad teams? It ain't that many of them. Like, I think about Charles Barkley in his last year in Philadelphia. Like, that's one that jumps out at me. But past that, I don't think, like, and look, some of you are going to hear this and then you're going to rattle them off, right? Like, okay, you can be well actually guy, but I think you understand what the point is that I'm trying to make. That's kind of, like, that's in the same realm as what we were talking about Steph before when we were talking about him as great system player. Now, the problem is the counterpoint that, like, we made in that discussion was Kyrie. And we've seen what happens if you put Kyrie on a team full of bums, they still stink, right? So, like, I ain't saying nothing crazy, like Kyrie Irving's a better basketball player than Steph Curry. But I think as far as we consider superstars, he is a unique one in the effect that he has on a team, in that if you put certain things around him, the sky is the limit. But that's how you got to do it. You've got to put those guys around him. And once you do, it can be on and popping. And so this year, for a lot of people who are not me, to be clear, this is your year to come back and look at Steph and be like, see, I told y'all he wasn't that good. And I've seen this happen. Gabe, I put the clip up of Steph shooting those jumpers. You saw we made like 100 straight jumpers in 5 minutes. I had people like, well, why doesn't he make this in the game? Well, anybody. No, not anybody. Well, all kinds of guys in the league can do that. Well, they're pretty damn impressive too, right? But no, this is the greatest shooter that we have ever seen. He has one of the rarest skill sets that we have ever seen. He is a great player. There's no need to qualify what his greatness is. Like, when me and Vinny talk about what's going on with Steph, we're talking about him relative to other spectacular players, where you have to nitpick a little bit in order to find the differences between them at the top, because they're all so great. That's where we are about this. And so I was looking early this year, because I'm like, yo, so what's this going to look like if it's just Steph out here with a bunch of bums? And Steph didn't look that much different at first than the bums. Except, did you look at those box scores on who exactly the bums were? Oh my God, they're so bad. Like, it's Steph Curry, Andrew Wiggins, Kelly Oubre, and just guys, people. Like, Kent Bazemore is back and he actually plays. I thought he was over there to keep morale high, right? I thought he was over there to do dances and stuff like that to keep people's heads in the game. Except the problem is, when y'all out here losing, there's nothing for Bazemore to do, so he might as well play.
It's like the years when they were so absurdly stacked that the 10th, 11th guys, you know, on their bench were like, who's that again? Who's that?
Yeah,
who's that?
Yeah.
Now those guys are playing.
Yes, that's exactly it. Those guys are playing. Like, you couldn't make any real referendum on Steph Curry based on the first 3 or 4 games of this season, because he was out. He was out there by himself. Like, as much as I say, I don't know how much Steph raises the floor, we were not dealing with a proper example. I'm like, yeah, James Harden and a bunch of bums probably wins 40 games. James Harden and those bums, I don't know if they win 40 games. Like, and the guys, I just don't know. It was so, and Draymond wasn't playing at that point. So I watched him play last night against the Kings with Draymond out there, and it's different. And it's different because they need Steph to make all the shots and make all the passes when Draymond's not out there. And that's too much to ask him. He's not that guy. Like, if you ask James Harden to make all the shots and make all the passes, he is capable of doing this. And I just keep using him as an example, not because I think he's better than Steph, right? I just think he's the right example to use in this case. I don't know if James Harden can make all the passes to those guys that were out there. Like, they look a lot better with Draymond, even though Draymond played in that game where they lost by 25 points to the Blazers, right? Like, it's going to be there, but it's going to be just interesting to watch Steph. I don't think you need to declare some kind of referendum of what kind of player that you think he is. I don't think you need to wrap your arms around him and save him. He's a three-time champion. He is a two-time MVP. He is one of the greatest players of all time. He is unequivocally the greatest shooter who has ever lived. But we're going to see how high he can raise the floor of a team. And to be fair also, it's a lot to ask of a player who is 6'3" to raise the floor of a team in that way, right? But like, I think Steph Curry is a better player than Chris Paul. But I think Chris Paul is a floor raiser in a different way. Because what happens is, you want to talk about somebody being the system. Chris Paul is the system. What do we do? Whatever Chris say. Chris get the ball. Chris tell everybody what to do. Chris, you know, has worked this all out in his head. And then it goes from there. Chris Paul to his brain, probably going to win you 40 games. You know, give him just a guy that can run to the rim at the very least. But Chris Paul and his brain, they probably go win you 40 games just by being out there. That's not what this is with Steph. You know what I mean? Like, this isn't, he's not raised the level of these other guys. He's not that dude, right? And I think that's largely an overstated notion with most people. But Steph can do incredible things to get his. And in the course of getting his, by you getting a little bit more open, he can help you get yours, you know? But it is going to be interesting to see this year what it looks like with Steph not playing with one of the 10 greatest shooters of all time. Because I do think that Klay does a lot for Steph that we don't think about. We think more about Steph doing this for Klay. But Klay's 6'7 standing in that corner. I think you can make an argument that the Klay Thompson that we see with Steph probably looks more similar to the Klay Thompson that we'd see without Steph than the Steph that we see without Klay Thompson is going to look compared to the Steph that we see with Klay Thompson. That is not to say that Steph Curry is not a better player than Klay Thompson. He is a better player than Klay Thompson. He is one of the greatest players that I have ever seen. But these are the nuances of his game that I want to see this year. And these are the things that we were trying to talk about before, just a bit more haphazard.
Heard something the other day, this writer for The Athletic, Carl Anka, he was saying that this one player raises the floor of a team, but another player raises the ceiling of yes. the team. But it's not to say necessarily that one player is better than the other. Like in this case, the player that raised the ceiling is a better player than the player that raises the floor. But it's just two different conversations, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's where we go. And so, Warriors fans, I'm going to say this to close this out because y'all think I hate your guy. This is a true story. In the year 2008, I was a writer for ESPN.com. And I mean, I in effect got fired at the end of 2007. They'll call it not renewing your contract. That's getting fired. I did not know what I was going to do with my life. I was working as an adjunct professor and a weekend radio sports talk host for the first time. And the tournament was in Raleigh that year. The first two rounds were in Raleigh. And everybody at the station, we all got passes and we came to the game. This is the 2008 NCAA tournament. And the teams that were assigned to this pod included Davidson. And so up to that point, I had heard about Steph Curry, but I had not seen Steph Curry. I was there when he lit up Gonzaga. I was there when he lit up Georgetown. And I will tell you what I told Steph Curry the first time I ever talked to him years later. And I said, you changed the direction of my life, because I watched that performance. And I said to myself, no, I'm going to do this. Like one way or another, I'm going to stay around this. I'm going to work in this world. Because if I get to see stuff like that from this seat, this is what I want to do. So if you think I hate Steph Curry, yeah. I hate the guy that motivated me to make all this money and to get on TV. How ungrateful you think I am?
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, Bomani, this first story comes from Health.
My name is Ben Elman. I'm a freelancer for NPR. I just turned in a story about the crazy waits for COVID tests in Manhattan. It isn't strange to hear that someone had to wait 3 or more hours in a line that wraps around the block just for a 30-second nose swab. These long lines started right before Thanksgiving and haven't let up since. That's why some people are turning to guys like Robert Samuel, a professional line stander. Robert runs a whole company where he and his employees stand in line for all the in-demand stuff around New York City. Exclusive meet and greets, fashion sample sales, new game consoles, you name it. But that was before March of 2020. His business pretty much disappeared in the early days of the pandemic, and now these virus test lines are what's keeping him afloat. For $60, he'll get up before dawn and hold your spot near the front of a testing line for 2 hours. Other people on gig apps like TaskRabbit have noticed the demand and started charging $80 an hour or more just to hold any place in line. There are a ton of ethical questions here. Manhattanites will pay anything for a little bit of convenience. The ones who can shell out for this service probably already have great health care. I also don't want to fault Robert, a black entrepreneur, for risking his health trying to keep his business going. On one hand, we're not talking about Hamilton tickets or a Supreme drop here. The people paying line standers are getting first access to vital health information. On the other hand, there are hundreds of testing locations around Manhattan. Between city-funded testing sites and chain urgent cares doing free testing, it's hard to believe a paid line stander is going to be at every one of them. Is it okay to pay to cut the line for a COVID test? In the end, everyone has to decide that for themselves.
I mean, I understand where everyone is coming from here. Gabe, I don't know about you, but I don't see an easy villain in this discussion. Shout out to my man for getting the bright idea that he was going to do this. I tell you this, you're going to have to pay me a lot more than $80 to stand in a line with people that might have COVID. Like, some of them are in line just because they want to go visit their parents. Some of them are in line because they got a fever.
Just look at the photo. Look at the photo that's attached to the story. When you're out waiting in line at the grocery store and you're thinking, is this person getting too close to me? When you're going to take the test, these are other people that think that they have COVID. It's like, get away from me.
Yeah, no. Like, look, I feel like they putting money in the local economy. You know what I'm saying? They put a little bread in somebody's pocket. And maybe because I'm speaking at this from the perspective of somebody that's like, yo, if I got to get a COVID test, that's exactly what I'll do. I'd pay more than $80 for you to do that. Yeah, I don't have a great answer for this, do you?
I get the ethical concerns behind it. It makes total sense. I also totally get the guy trying to make a buck off of it.
I don't think anybody thinks that the person who is morally wrong here is the guy trying to make the money. It is the people who have the money, who are giving the money to this guy and then are, in effect, skipping the line. Like, that is probably, like, that, I guess, is where the ethics come up in the way they describe that the ethics come up. And wow, I ain't gonna lie. It just leads me to want to say a bunch of things that would make my father horrified. Like, sounds like you need to get your money up.
All right, this next story comes from business.
I'm Michael Hiltzik, business columnist for the Los Angeles Times. You may have heard about futures trading in gold, wheat, even if you've seen the Eddie Murphy movie Trading Places, frozen concentrated orange juice. And yes, that's a real thing. But those ever-innovative folks on Wall Street have cooked up something new. A few weeks ago, they started trading futures on water, specifically California water. The California water futures market makes a lot of people nervous because for the first time, futures are being traded on a critical natural resource. We can't live without water, and if the supply comes under the control of profit-oriented investors, a lot of bad things can happen for people who don't have the ability to buy at any price. The promoters of this futures contract say not to worry. Unlike gold or wheat or OJ, this futures contract can't be settled by trading the underlying commodity, but only in cash. It won't move a drop of water, they say, from one place to another. It's really designed to enable farmers, the biggest users of water in the state, to hedge against price increases for the water they need for irrigation. Because agricultural water is scarce and growers can't be guaranteed that they'll get all they need from low-priced providers like the state and federal governments, they have to buy extra water on the open market. The futures allow them to lock in a price for that. But there wouldn't be a need for this market if not for the fact that water is becoming increasingly scarce in the West, mostly due to climate change and the rapid growth of Western cities. So if nothing else, The new futures contract is a warning that more scarcity is coming. The concern is that if more people can deal with this scarcity by just locking in a price, they'll have less incentive to do what they have to do to address the real causes of scarcity, like climate change and wasteful water usage.
Yo, that's scary, Gabe. Like, we that close to running out of water?
I always like bring this up when we talk about water scarcity. You know my favorite movie, Chinatown?
Yeah.
Water scarcity in LA, which is like a desert island on land, they've got to pump water into Los Angeles and into the surrounding areas from like the Colorado River.
Yeah, yeah. No. We're running out of water, guys. We're running out of water and they're selling it. Future, that's all we're doing. Taking bets on the price of water. And somebody there believes the price is going to go up because the scarcity is going to go up. Which, I mean, on one hand, we knew. On the other hand, this is still scary.
All right, so this last story comes from tech. I figured I'd do it myself because it's such a short one. Did you or did you not see over the Christmas break the dancing robots at our place, Boston Dynamics, that people associate with, if you haven't heard?
I did.
Yeah, so Boston Dynamics, they're a robotics company up there. They've got a little dog. They've got like a little man that are pretty amazing in terms of what they can do. There's a video that surfaced. I'll put it in the show notes of all these robots dancing around to Do You Love Me?
Do you love me? That one.
It's not the first time that they've shown off like dancing skills and stuff like that. But this was like really, really incredible. So wanted to bring it up because it's so associated with the segment to see your thoughts on it.
Retweet if you thought the robots might have been able to dance better than you. Retweet and favorite if you as a black person thought that robot might have been able to dance better than you. I retweeted and favorited. Like, I'm not positive it could dance better than me. Like, if I'm drunk, I could dance better than it. But like, you just asked me to go do it right now? Tough call. Tough call. What got me about that video was how they just kept adding more dancers. Like, that was what got me. I was like, yo, this is the... Oh, wow, there's another one. And why is there a dinosaur out here doing this dance? Like, it basically looked like a robotic dinosaur. And, I mean, I gotta be honest. That seems like a waste of everything. Like, nobody wants to watch robots dance.
Yeah, so I mean, Boston Dynamics is getting bought up by Hyundai. In line with what we're going to talk about in the voicemail segment, this could be their mailing it in.
We're out. We've had enough. Yeah, this is what we got these robots doing. Nah, man, this is all just getting way. We're doomed. Yeah, like that's how pessimistic I've grown. You show me a cute video of robots dancing, and I'm just like, oh man, we're doomed.
Yeah, I mean, for the robots that didn't have as many appendages, where it was just kind of like two or three parts, they were flexing in a way that a lot of people could learn from, including myself.
Yeah, I need to study their moves, right? If they can do it, so can I. Like I need to better myself.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bomani. So the end of the season in the NFL happened. Some people calling out Doug Peterson, right? Saying that they were mailing it in the last game of the season. Last couple of weeks of 2020, people were mailing it in. You know they were. So Bo called out for voicemails from when people were mailing it in, a time when they mailed it in
and knew it.
Our first comes from Gerald in Miami.
I was a manager at a restaurant on South Beach, and I'm the one that set up the restaurant in the daytime. I come in, I open the door, I let everybody in, you know, get the day started. So it was Christmas, probably one of the busiest days of the year. I woke up in the morning. I just said, man, I'm not going in. I had the keys. All the employees were waiting outside to come into work. All the deliveries were backed up outside. They kept blowing up my phone. This was about, I don't know, 10 years ago. I still haven't answered my phone since.
Ain't nothing like that last day at work, and I'm just putting the phone on hold. One of my homeboys, his last day at the job, the first thing he did was say, cancel my email account. That was the first thing he did, was have them revoke his logon privileges. First thing.
How quick do you think it would have been till they broke down the door?
That's a great question. That is a great question.
Because that's also like, how much trust do you have in this guy that Gerald's going to show up versus how much it's going to cost to replace that back door after you bust it down?
Yeah. I think there would have been no reason to waste time.
All right, this next one, this guy didn't leave his name or where he's from. It was a good one, though.
Hey, what's up, Bo? What's up, Gabe? All right, time where I quit was at the end of my fourth year of undergrad. I was a good student. I got good grades in high school, which afforded me an opportunity to go to good college. I was doing very, very good in college, but this is at the end of that long haul of freshman, sophomore, junior year, senior year of grinding. I was taking a 2-credit class, pass, fail. So I only had to get a certain percentage of the class correct to actually get that pass. And I was just done. I couldn't do it. The last assignment to get that pass was a 2-page double-spaced paper. And I just could not find it in me to do this paper. I did submit it via email, but I didn't attach the paper hoping that this would buy me time. So over break, when the teacher finally found out and told me that I had not attached anything, I said, oh, no, I'll attach it as soon as I can. And Bo, I never attached the paper. I had a semester left of school left, so I just took it again. And I had all the answers for the class. So to be honest, I schemed the system, got my degree, graduated.
Look, man, when I was in high school, we used to be able to exempt out of exams if you had like a high enough average and few enough absences. I did the math on just about every class and was like, okay, so what do I need to give you in order to just not have to take this exam for like the the final 6-week period of the year? Oh, yeah, it was cruise control. It was cruise control, baby. Like, once you tell me everything else has already been settled, yeah, it's cruise control, baby.
Man, pass fails have been running wild with COVID. These universities are trying to make it as easy as they can on students, right? Because it's a difficult time. But what it leads to is you can take every class on pass fail. If you know that you're in the region of passing a class, you don't have to do a damn thing.
Yeah, and see, this is my thing where I see a lot of people where they're like, why are you grading these kids? It's hard enough on them. Like, and that just tells me everything we've done wrong in terms of what a grade means. The grade should not be an achievement. The grade should be a reflection, like a reflection of how you've done, so we can look at it and see, you know, your level of mastery of whatever it is and so forth and so on. People just look at it like, you're punishing me with this bad grade, you know, but everything is going hard. And I get where you understand what I'm saying, though, right? Like, I'm not blaming the people because they've been socialized into these ways, but no, they're like, yo, we should just waive standardized tests these year. If the standardized test ever had a value, then it still has a value, right? So what you're calling out is that the things maybe don't have a value, but the presence of COVID doesn't mean that we don't need to test if the test has any actual value. In fact, the presence of COVID indicates that we need to test more because we need to know more about what people are or are not learning in these times, except people don't view them as tests. They're achievement hurdles. And that's why our whole education system is
All right, this last one, the guy didn't leave his name or where he's from, but it's a good one to close it out.
Hey, what's up, Bo? So I was in the Army, and so I was in the Army get ready to leave, and I had 2 weeks to separate, and I was going to be gone. And you was going to be going to the field for those 2 weeks. So I'm like, cool, I'm going to just go through the motions, and I ain't even got to go to the field because I got the Army in 2 weeks, I'll be back home. So I'm helping them load the trucks, man. They get ready to go and do their stuff in the field. And so I'm like, yeah, man, I guess I'll see you. So my first thought is like, what you mean? I was like, hey, man, y'all gonna be in the field for 2 weeks? ITA in 2 weeks. I'm gonna be out here. I'm gonna be out the Army in 2 weeks. He said, no, you coming. I said, I'm coming. He said, yeah, you gotta come. I said, what about my separation stuff? You'll handle that in a day. It won't take long. So we're loading the truck. One of my partners in the back, and we're on the back of this truck loading things up. Nobody looking. I crossed my arms, and I took a quick dive. I fell off the truck, and then, man, I just rolled off. Actually, I rolled off the truck, man, and I said, I'm hurting. I'm hurting. And, man, they came to the back. Everybody's devastated. Man, they got the medic out there, put me on the chopper. They put me back to the base. I was back at the hospital, man. Man, I was in the hospital for 2 days. And the next week and a half I was there, man, I was just chilling, going home. Man, going to tell me he's going to have me out in the field. Man, I'm going home. I ain't doing this no more.
Yeah, man, can't really blame him. Gave a fella, got a point.
taking a dive. As long as you're not like going to seriously injure yourself, because you don't want to be like you and I talked about before we got on today about how when you get older, things hurt a little bit more. What if you dive off the back of that truck, tear your ACL? Never the same.
Yeah, that's going the extra mile right there. That is, I have to admit, that is going the extra mile. But hey, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.